Chapter 29. Epitaph for a Friend. As I lay with my head in your lap, camarado, the confession I made, I resume. What I said to you in the open air, I resume. I know I am restless, and make others so. I know my words are weapons, full of danger, full of death. Indeed, I am myself the real soldier. It is not he there with his bayonet, and not the red-striped artilleryman. For I confront peace, security, and all the settled laws to unsettle them. I am more resolute because all have denied me than I could ever have been had all accepted me. I heed not, and have never heeded, either experience, cautions, majorities, nor ridicule. And the threat of what is called hell is little or nothing to me, and the lure of what is called heaven is little or nothing to me. Dear camarado, I confess I have urged you onward with me, and still urge you, without the least idea, what is our destination, or whether we shall be victorious, or utterly quelled and defeated. Walt Whitman. Chapter 30. Duck Speak. You remember when I said how I was going to explain about life, buddy? Well, the thing about life is, it gets weird. People are always talking about truth. Everybody always knows what the truth is, like it was toilet paper or something. And they got a supply in the closet. But what you learn as you get older is there ain't no truth. All there is bullshit. Pardon my vulgarity here. Layers of it. One layer of bullshit on top of another. And what you do in life, like when you get older, is you pick the layer of bullshit that you prefer, and that's your bullshit, so to speak. Bernie LaPlante, Hero. I return to the arena half an hour later and find everyone spread out in small groups, standing and seated, drinking and munching on treats from a well-stocked snack table that has mysteriously appeared, engaged in a variety of conversations. I exchange smiles with Lisa, who is in close conversation with the mysterious Dr. Kim. I stroll from group to group and listen in, and hear talk of Brett, talk of the story Lisa just shared, talk of the critical differences between the Rinzai and Soto schools of Zen, talk of boyfriend shortcomings, talk of an exciting new spiritual teacher in Maryland who has her students roll their eyes up during meditation so they can see their third eye, and talk of local restaurants. I move on. I respond to questions when asked, but mostly listen. Lawrence, the fellow holding forth on Zen, I find out, has spent 20 years meditating his ass off under several different Zen masters in New York and out west, and is currently writing a book about his experiences. He informs me that my views on Zen are far too simplistic, that there is infinitely more to Zen than the hot and narrow pursuit of enlightenment. I thank him without irony and drift back over to the folks I heard talking about local restaurants, but they're talking about something else now. Zen, I have to admit, really grinds my nuts. It has been a subject of confusion and frustration for me since forever. When I think about Zen, I know there's something there. But when I look at Zen, I can't seem to find it. Churchill said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. Similarly, I'd say that Zen is the worst path to enlightenment, except for all the others. It's not just that Zen has been westernized, bastardized, homogenized, and commercialized beyond all recognition. I've looked back over the centuries into the history of Zen and have found that it has long since drifted safely away from its dangerous center. I have looked at many highly revered Zen masters, East and West, and one thing is very clear. Zen master is not synonymous with awakened, truth-realized being. Frankly, I don't know what the hell a Zen master is if he's not awake, or what the hell Zen is if not the annihilation of the ego. But anyone who uses those criteria to refine their personal Zen search will instantly see their results plummet from millions of strong hits to a dubious handful, with very few of the big names surviving the purge. The sincere aspirant could spend the next decade in a Zen monastery, sit at the feet of a revered Zen master, perform Zazen with perfect discipline, endure the pain and the stick and the agonizing hours and the selfless toil, soak up every word, every parable, every drop of teaching, and ultimately know nothing more about Zen than the cabbie who picks him up when he finally calls it quits. And here's the funny thing. Even as he's leaving, knowing that the whole thing was a total waste of time, he'd also know that he wasn't wrong. He'd know he picked right, and that what he wanted was in there somewhere. He just never found it. All that other Zen got in the way. Zen is a race car without an engine. It looks very cool, but without an engine, it can't take us anywhere. We can slip in behind the wheel and make engine sounds and turn the wheel and shift gears and pretend we're rocketing across the spiritual landscape. But when we get tired of it in 10 minutes or 10 years, we'll get out of this sexy little hot rod exactly where we got into it. So why go on about it? I hadn't actually thought about Zen much since writing the first book, but over the summer, and on the trip here, I have given a lot of thought to Lisa's experience, and it occurred to me that in her I was seeing the real Zen, a force so powerful and inexorable that it can reach into someone's life unbidden and hurl that person like a rag doll into the furnace of disillusionment. That's some crazy shit. I mean, there she was, a perfect housewife, supermom, career gal, and all-round high achiever. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, bam! Her perfect little connect-the-dots life gets nuked back to infancy. Not into enlightenment, but into and through the death-rebirth process that marks the beginning of the journey, of any journey. What I was seeing in Lisa was the real Zen, not the long-dead Zen of myth and marketplace, not the sideshow corpse of Zen that still lurks in the rubes, or the tap-dancing Zen zombie selling energy drinks and lawn ornaments at the bidding of the dollar-eyed Svengalis on Madison Avenue, but the inferno at the very core of Zen. Without training, without middlemen, without stated desire or specific intent, Lisa had somehow managed to plunge straight into the heart of things. Why Lisa? I wondered. Why was she different? Millions of people saw that picture of the falling woman, and many others like it. The world is full of seemingly senseless tragedy. We're all dangling by a thread, and everyone gets a reminder of that now and then. Not everyone does what Lisa did, though. Most of us turn away from such an unsettling revelation, but Lisa didn't. She turned toward it. She wouldn't or couldn't let herself turn away. Was it destiny or free will or the timeless, spaceless other? I have no idea. But what I do know is that what she did is what virtually all spiritual aspirants, to all appearances, should be doing and aren't. Relinquishing the illusion of control. But appearances can be deceiving, and spiritual aspirants don't always know to what, if anything, they aspire. That's what Brett was figuring out when she stopped having these meetings. In Zen terms, what Lisa managed to do in 3 difficult years was empty her cup. An impressive and remarkably uncommon feat, especially for one so deeply rooted in life as Lisa was. She never asked for it. She never wanted it. But it came, and she dealt with it. Impermanence had become Lisa's own personal koan, and those thousands of minutes she spent staring at that blurry photo of the falling woman was her Zazen practice. This is real Zen, burning from the inside out of a real person. Who cares about one hand clapping, or your face before you were born, or any of those quaint little mind-benders? What's more mind-bending than your own looming death? What could be more devastating to ego than the contemplation of meaninglessness and insignificance, of nothingness, of no self? Here was Lawrence, a clever, dedicated man with 20 years of Zen study under his belt, writing the obligatory book and already signed up for the next 20 years, and he's made as much real progress as anyone I might pick out of a crowd, or a lot less, depending on how you reckon anti-progress. And here was Lisa, with no interest, no motivation, deeply established in her well-worn circular path, and she had achieved a level of success a seasoned veteran like Lawrence wouldn't even recognize as such. We can use the opportunity afforded by Lisa's experience to take a closer look at Zen, I tell the group after calling them back to order. In spite of itself, Zen is what we're talking about when we talk about peeling away the many-layered fabric of false identity. If you take away all the trappings of Zen, the teachings and the ceremonies, the different schools, the postures and the koans, everything you think of as Zen, and throw it all into the fire, what survives? What is the true core of Zen after all the veils and vanities have burned away? I pause because I want them to think about it. The fire, I answer. The fire is what's left. The fire is Zen. Lawrence is shaking his head. You're free to speak, Lawrence, I say. He sighs in exasperation and stands up. He addresses not just me, but the entire group. He talks about the real Zen that I seem to be ignoring. He talks about patriarchs and ancient roots and Zen today. He pays homage to his own teachers and their teachers. He talks about heritage and philosophy, training and lifestyle, practice and dedication, personal struggle, tradition, commitment, sacrifice. He is intelligent, eloquent, and expert on his subject. I let him continue for a few minutes because I'm optimistic, on Brett's behalf, that some of the people here tonight are looking at Lawrence and seeing what I'm seeing, a little boy who is scared of the dark and has spent his life burrowing into the fortress of Zen, the grown-up version of huddling under blankets, hiding from some imagined boogeyman. Parents tell their children that there is no such thing as the boogeyman, but that's because they themselves have never thrown off the covers and turned on the lights. There is such a thing as the boogeyman. He is out to get you, and he will. The boogeyman is real. He is the most real thing in the dream state. And real Zen, if there is such a thing, is about turning toward him, not away. While he speaks, Lawrence tries several times to engage me, to draw me in. But I know better and gesture for him to continue without me. The first rule in this business is never let them drag you down into their imagined realms. He wants to pull me down into the muck and mire of words and concepts and debate, into the warm ooze of perpetual stalemate. That is his element. That's where he and many like him are most comfortable, making their engine sounds, busily going nowhere. I watch the group as Lawrence speaks. It's not always easy to remember that these people aren't like me. They look and sound awake, but they're not. They are asleep and dreaming, sleepwalking and sleep talking. Their words make sense to them inside their dream world, but from my perspective, it's mostly mumbling. They seldom express a lucid thought or formulate a coherent question. In several minutes of uninterrupted discourse on Zen, Lawrence has not said anything that I recognize as being related to the topic of awakening from delusion. As he watched the eyeless face with the jaw moving rapidly up and down, Winston had a curious feeling that this was not a real human being, but some kind of dummy. It was not the man's brain that was speaking. It was his larynx. The stuff that was coming out of him consisted of words, but it was not speech in the true sense. It was a noise uttered in unconsciousness, like the quacking of a duck. George Orwell, 1984. So how can we communicate across this great divide? Metaphors and well-known stories, like books and movies, provide a common ground where ideas can be expressed. But if we drift away from that shared territory in either direction, it's like a radio tuner drifting away from a clear channel into static. If you're standing out here in front of these people and you're attached to results, as Brett was, then it's only natural that you'd get a little aggravated and finally give up. The gulf that separates these states is very real, and all attempts to communicate across it are inherently quixotic. It's not until a student or aspirant or reader starts closing the consciousness gap from their side that any real communication can start taking place, until someone understands what it really means that their eyes are closed and begins the process of unseeing what's not. Nothing Brett or I might say could really make much difference. The wall separating the awakened and unawakened states is not conceptual, or theoretical, or metaphorical. Intelligence can't pierce it. Piety can't melt it. Fervor can't smash it. It is a force field empowered by the emotional energy of fear. So everything we hurl against it is rechanneled into it. Only ego death defeats this barrier, because the barrier is ego itself. The segregated self must recede for the integrated being to emerge. The whole evening will last more than 4 hours, less than 2 hours of that time spent with me addressing the group. Mostly it's just easy conversation and quiet remembrance. We speak casually for another half hour. Together, we talk about the Bhagavad Gita to see if Krishna isn't actually Maya, and if the song of the Lord isn't actually a lullaby. We talk about the Matrix and lay it like a template over our own world to see how it fits and where everyone fits in it, including us here tonight in this horse arena. "Are you Morpheus?" one person asks me. "Brett was more like Morpheus," says another. "Jed's more like a program." "No, he's the red pill," another answers, and everyone laughs. Many of them have brought their copies of Damnedest and Incorrect with them tonight, so a lot of their questions come from the books. We talk about 1984, with which they're somewhat familiar, about Moby Dick, which many own but few have read, and about Whitman and Thoreau and U.G. Krishnamurti. It's all very nice and pleasant in the arena, with only a few lights on and the soft rain falling outside and a gentle breeze passing through. As long as we stay on the subject of the books, or within the framework of metaphors and allegories, we are able to enjoy an interesting and instructive exchange. Of these 70 people, I know that maybe one, but probably none, will actually do anything. They're mostly just tourists, which is fine with me, but it was a tough realization for Brett. Of those I have observed, Dr. Kim seems the most sincere, and I know he's not going to blast out of his holy trinity, work, home, family, due to the minor technicality that he's playing a fictional character in a fictional world. Lawrence is so deep into his role of dedicated Zen adherent that he'll never get another glimpse of daylight. There are others who seem equally sincere or dedicated, but a closer look reveals that it's written into their character to seem sincere or dedicated, or that their spirituality has been clumsily retrofitted, like a pressure relief valve not specified in the original design. Of course, there's always the one that surprises you. Maybe there's a Lisa or a Brett up in those bleachers somewhere. If there is, it probably won't be any of the most likely candidates, but one of the quiet ones, sitting in the back, slowly building up some heat, starting to burn from the inside. I take a break and wander down to the lake. When I get there, I see that my concerns about fitting in all these people have already been addressed. More than an acre of lakeside field has been cleared and mowed. A medium-sized white canopy has been erected, and there are at least 100 folding chairs set up in semicircle facing the fire pit and the lake. I had hoped to be able to scare up a dozen logs and a pint of gas for the fire, but that's been taken care of, too. A large, well-kindled bonfire is waiting to be touched off. The area around the fire pit, which was cramped with 20 people in the past, was now mown and groomed to handle 100. I knew all this lakeside tribute part would work itself out, that we could get a fire built and squeeze everybody in somehow, but I had no idea it would be taken care of like this. Dr. Kim. I'm sure right away that he put all this together, as Nicole would confirm for me later. Dr. Kim arranged landscapers and day laborers, got the chairs, tent, and a few tables from his temple, and had the whole thing ready in 3 days. I have the last cigar I got from Frank. This is a bit pre-planned. I wanted to create a pause in tonight's events in which I could come down to the lake alone, light a cigar, walk a quiet lap around the lake, and just think about things. I've done a lot of cool things in my life, more than just jumping out of planes and writing some books and escaping delusion. But I know no greater pleasure than taking a nice walk in a nice place on a nice night. I wish Maya was with me. "I'm always with you," she says. "I meant the dog," I reply. The rain has stopped. The clouds are parting, and a nearly full moon is peeking through. Perfect. I light the cigar and begin my walk. This little stroll around the lake is supposed to be quiet and reflective and soaked with meaning as I pay silent tribute to Frank and Brett and many others who have played important roles in my own journey. I know things are winding down for me, and this is supposed to be like my victory lap, where I look back over one life and perhaps forward to another. I should know better than to try to pull such a schmaltzy stunt. The cigar tastes like crap. It needs the booze for counterpoint, and I have no booze. The lake path Brett walked so many thousands of times is now overgrown with brambles like razor wire. I get about 50 feet before chucking the whole thing is a bad idea. The cigar goes into the lake, and I go back to the riding arena. Sentimental bullshit. Chapter 31. The Demon Tamer. The only thing that burns in hell is the part of you that won't let go of your life, your memories, your attachments. They burn them all away, but they're not punishing you. They're freeing your soul. If you're frightened of dying and you're holding on, you'll see devils tearing your life away. If you've made your peace, then the devils are really angels freeing you from the earth. Lewis, Jacob's Ladder. Attributed to Meister Eckhart. Most of you probably know that I managed to arrive at the truth-realized state through the writing process, spiritual autolysis. I talked about that in the first book. Anyone who manages to do it has a way they managed to do it. Does anyone know how Brett managed to do it? A few hands are tentatively raised. I point to a guy in front. "Something to do with her father," he says. "A lot to do with her father," I confirm, though it was a few years after he died. He was a military guy, an officer. So Brett was an army brat. She lived in a bunch of different places, different countries. Her father was an extremely critical person, found fault with everything, always very judgmental. That's what Brett told me about him. Even after he died, he was still a constant presence in her mind. You all know what it's like to have a critical voice in your head? Some person or thought or emotion that has taken up residence in your head and tends to be a bit on the obnoxious side? Everyone raises a hand and nods with grim familiarity. Well, those are demons. Demon is a useful way to describe anything in our heads that we don't want there, and which seems to have a mind of its own, something that haunts us or has power over us, has its hooks into us, memories, people, addictions. They torment us in a variety of ways, But the main thing demons do is hold us back, restrict our progress. This is Brett's final lesson for you, by the way. This comes from her. She explained all this to me one night last year. We were sitting down at the lake after a meeting. The fire was dying down, and she told me about what a fierce presence her father had been in her mind. Always there, always critiquing and belittling, a real cancer of the spirit. Normally, I'm not very tolerant of that sort of disclosure. If Brett had been a student of mine, I would have encouraged her to stop dawdling over childhood grievances and maladies, to leave it behind and move on. Sounds of disapproval rise from the bleachers. Maybe that sounds cruel, I continue, but problems of this nature are solved by transcending them, not by dealing with them. We are in the business of slaying demons, not feeding them. This is getting me a lot of scowls and dubious stares, so I have to say more. I'd planned to keep it simple by limiting my discussion to Brett's father, as extreme an example of demonhood as you're likely to find. But now I see that demonology is something we should take a few minutes to look at. Imagine you're climbing out of a dark sewer, and some beast has its teeth sunk into your leg, making a lot of noise and tearing at you and weighing you down. A demon. Are you going to jump back down into the sewer and fight it? A lot of people think that's the answer. But why do that? It's tough to slay demons because they're symptoms, not causes. And even if you kill one, there are always more. What's next? A fight to the death with your obsessive neatness? Pistols at dawn with your love of chocolate? The only real result of these little battles is that you haven't gone anywhere. You're still in the sewer. All you've really killed is time, and time is all you really have. You haven't killed a demon. You've lost a piece of your life. And that means they've won. The part of you that's afraid to move forward has won. You have to ask yourself, what's your objective? To achieve mental equilibrium in a sewer? Or to climb out of it? To slay every little demon? Or to rise up out of the realms they inhabit? Don't laugh like it's obvious. Everyone seeks solutions within the sewer rather than escape from it. Battling demons is the ultimate form of shadow boxing. You're just punching at an empty projection of yourself. For our purposes, if demons aren't demonizing you, then they don't exist. It's as simple as that. Sounds like a cop-out, says Justin. Like a way of not dealing with your issues. Who agrees with Justin? I ask the group, and many people nod or raise their hands. So do I agree. It does sound like a cop-out, but dealing with our issues is the real cop-out. It's our way of avoiding the real war by engaging ourselves at the level of minor skirmishes. Who wouldn't prefer to struggle against their addiction to caffeine instead of their addiction to mindless conformity? They laugh. As we develop a subtler and more refined understanding of what a demon is, identifying them by what they do, not how they look, we begin to see that demons aren't limited to addictions and critical voices. It's not just negative attachments that hold us captive within ego's sphere. It's all attachments. The approach to life and spirituality, where we decrease bad things like sins and addictions and increase good things like love and compassion, never has and never will move anyone a single step in the direction of awakening. They look half dubious, half confused. For example, I explain, if I were a gambling addict, then a large portion of my life energy, my time, my thoughts and emotions would be spent either gambling or fighting my urge to gamble. But for our purposes, feeding my addiction and fighting it are really the same thing. Whether my gambling demon is beating me or I'm beating it doesn't matter. All that matters is that I'm sitting in my prison cell fully engaged in processes that will never move me one inch closer to liberation. That's what demons do. They're like Maya's army of winged monkeys. They always fight a delaying action that expends our resources and prevents us from making forward progress. That's their objective, to occupy us, not to defeat us. There's an interesting parallel in 1984. The country of Oceania has the power to create a high standard of living for everyone, but the ruling party wishes to keep everyone impoverished and thereby enslaved. The problem was how to keep the wheels of industry turning without increasing the real wealth of the world. Goods must be produced, but they must not be distributed. And in practice, the only way of achieving this was by continuous warfare. George Orwell, 1984. Continuous warfare. People toiling in factories producing ships and tanks that are destroyed in a perpetual war that is never won or lost. People stay busy and production stays high while their standard of living stays low and their hope of overthrowing their oppressors stays non-existent. Demons are similar in that they don't exist to win or lose, but only to keep us busy. Say, for instance, that after 20 years of fighting my gambling addiction, I finally manage to overcome it. What would I have to show for that victory? 20 years gone. Demons keep us unfocused and distracted, I continue, which is something the spiritual autolysis is very effective at cutting through. The need to deal with tormenting demons comes up again and again as we progress, so you have to know what to do as a matter of policy. Keep climbing or jump down and fight? My advice? Fight when you have to. Climb when you can. Further is everything. Use the writing to keep yourself in tight focus, and the demons will die from lack of attention. Isn't it possible that these demons could be used in a positive way? Asks Shanti. You talk about how dark emotions can be useful. Is there any way demons might be useful too? Yes, I say. And that brings us right back to Brett. This father presence in her mind was much more serious than any of us can probably imagine. I'd never heard anything like it before Brett told me about it. I've looked into it since then, and I found out that for some people, these critical internal voices can be really shattering. No one moves or speaks. I don't think Brett ever got too touchy-feely in the meetings. She was as naturally indifferent to mundane emotional, psychological, and biographical content as I am. The point isn't to study and understand and cherish the bags of rocks we carry. The point is to drop them. This is all back when Brett was just a normal person, before any sort of awakening at all, no interest in any of it. The presence of this father demon in her mind was constant and highly toxic. Whatever she was doing or thinking, it was there, loud, contemptuous, undermining. She spent an hour telling me what this was like for her, and I found myself intrigued because she wasn't sad or sobbing or self-pitying. She was smiling with that air of a warrior recounting tales of battles won and lost. Even when she was quiet and thoughtful, she could tell a good story. Everyone laughs and smiles. What she told me was that it just got to be too much. She couldn't stand the presence of this hypercritical asshole in her head anymore. She said life had no pleasure. Nothing she did was good enough. She couldn't enjoy anything. She was trying to find relief in alcohol and drugs. I assume this is a more severe case than most of you are familiar with. Eyes are wide. No one responds to the contrary. This was her whole life since she was a kid. 20 years of this negative, nagging voice in her head. She was suicidal. Think about that. That's how bad it was. That's how serious this was for her. She knew it would never go away. She knew she couldn't fight it. She knew that no matter what she did in her life, this voice in her head would always be there sucking the joy out of it, ruining everything. And once her father died, there was no way she could even confront him in person and make a meaningful change in their relationship, which left her even more hopeless. She was trapped. No way out. That's how she described it to me, through that hard smile. Did you all know she had cancer? That jolts them. I was pretty sure they didn't know. Dr. Kim knew, but not the rest. Not a big surprise, I suppose, that a malignancy of the mind and spirit would eventually manifest as a malignancy of the body. This was in her late 20s, before any of us knew her. By the time they caught it, the prognosis was bleak, and it got her thinking more and more about the larger issues. I pause and pace and let my thoughts get out of the way. She told me that at her lowest point, she was in terrible shape. Low weight, her musculature was seized up, migraines, poor sleep, always tense and hunched, doped up on meds and sick from chemo. She lived here, on the farm, but not as a going concern. No animals, no crop or gardens. She still had this critical voice in her head mocking every thought, and she had a pretty dire prognosis from the doctors. "She beat it, though, right?" asks Justin. "I mean, that was more than 10 years ago, right? She beat the cancer?" I look at all the faces looking eagerly to me for this answer. "She kicked its ass," I reply to Justin. "You saw her. You knew her. Did she seem sickly, seized up, weak, fatigued?" "No," he says. "How did she beat it?" "How do you think?" I ask back. I turn to the entire group. "How do you think Brett beat cancer? Chemo? Alternative medicine? Power of prayer? Positive thinking? A Mexican clinic? A visualization technique?" I pace back and forth and give it time. "Anyone? How do you think Brett defeated what was diagnosed as advanced stage terminal cancer?" Finally, I stop in front of Dr. Kim. "Sir?" He looks up at me and speaks in a choked whisper. "She stopped fighting," he says. "She stopped fighting," I say after an extended pause. "She stopped resisting. Everything she'd been pushing against for so many years, she now began to allow. She knew She was defeated. She knew she had nothing to lose. She wasn't finding the support she needed in church or in medicine or anywhere else. So she just stopped fighting. I pause for a minute to let them get the wrong idea. I know this sounds counterintuitive, I continue, like giving up, like weakness. But when I say she stopped fighting, what I mean is that she stopped routing all her energy into her shields. This one simple act is the key to everything. It's the transition point from segregated to integrated, from childhood to adulthood. Ego is obstruction. Surrender is flow. Surrender is the basis and precursor of growth. It is of the essence. There is no shortcut or workaround, no substitute or alternate route. You can fake it, and many do, but you're only cheating yourself. There is no growth possible within egoic constraints, only the illusion of growth. Prior to surrender, there's ego, the puny, ignorant, segregated self. Once we free ourselves from that noxious and artificial puniness, we come into alignment. Bam! Just like that. It may take days, or months, or years for the various aspects of our lives to make the adjustment, but the initial impact is as dramatic and distinct as climbing out of a dark, fetid sewer into the clean air and dazzling sunlight. Before that, we're just silly, self-absorbed, rat-like little beings. But after that transition, after we have stopped asserting a false apartness, we are of the same dimension and magnitude as the ocean of being into which we merge. Virtually all of religion and spirituality is about being happy and ignorant in the sewer, because that's what people want. But this is about climbing out. If you're happy in the sewer, then it's not a sewer to you. If you don't think it stinks, then that's fine. But then, why are you here? The assumption when you stand in front of someone like me or Brett is that you know it's a sewer and you want out. I turn and walk away from the group. Nice to have so much space to move in. I turn and walk back. You're pretty hard on religion and all the spiritual and New Age teachings, says a woman I don't recognize. There's a whole world of knowledge and wisdom out there. Do you really think it's fair to tar it all with the same brush? It doesn't matter what I think. I'm just telling you what I see, and what you'll see if you open your eyes and look. If you disagree, open your eyes and tell me you see something else. I promise that if you do that, you'll be my new favorite person. I don't necessarily agree with your premise, she says, that my eyes are not open. I think I see the same things you see. Okay, then. Again, no offense, but you're here as a tourist with no vested interest, a spectator, not a participant. That's the case with most people, but most of you here tonight would probably be nursing some degree of healthy self-doubt. Anyway, I'm not trying to convince you of anything. I just don't know why you're here. She looks sour. I return my attention to the full group. I'm working backward from the complete and total failure of the world's spiritual and religious teachings to facilitate awakening, even those that claim to be dedicated to that exact purpose, especially those. I see this failure, and I see Maya, and I understand everything clearly. The intellectual and emotional power of ignorance is fully visible to me, and I can tell you that all the compassion and meditation in the world won't drag you up out of that sewer. No breadth of knowledge or depth of understanding translates into a single rung of upward progress. No one can push you, pull you, or go with you. All thoughts, ideas, feelings, concepts, and systems of knowledge and belief boil down to this one unequivocal distinction. Sewer or sunshine, dungeon or daylight, ego or surrender, obstruction or flow, segregation or integration, vertical entrenchment or horizontal progress. This isn't about spirituality or enlightenment or anything lofty. It's just about living your life honestly or dishonestly. They sit quietly, attentively. Fear converts every inward thought and impulse right back outward. Maya turns everything to her purpose. That's what you're up against. It's a death match, and there's only one way to win, and Brett found it. She stopped fighting. She surrendered. It's ego that fights, that resists, that sucks all our energy. Brett dropped her armor and exposed her breastbone to her enemy. And in so doing, she destroyed the enemy. Maya is not outside of us. Ultimately, she's just another internal demon. Routing our power against her or to her are the same thing. And when we stop empowering her, and she ceases to exist. These books would never be complete if I didn't get this said. Within the context of living a long and happy life full of people and diversions, being stuck in a jail cell or a wheelchair or a hospital bed or an unresponsive body might seem like the very definition of hell. But that's a factor of the context, not the circumstances. Do I mean to say that terminal illness and physical disability and institutional incarceration are just minor nuisances? I mean exactly that. Within the context of growth, progress, development, motion, realization, liberation, the tables are turned, and the physically constrained might actually enjoy a considerable advantage over the freely mobile. Focus, intent, vision, will, heart, clarity, maturity, seriousness, warrior spirit. That's what's needed. Not the ability to run out to the market when we want a snack. We may not be able to change our circumstances, but we can change our context. A prison cell can be a Zendu. From a wheelchair, we can fight a war. If we are physically restricted, there may be many things we can't do. But if we can still possess the sword of mind and the heart of will, there is still one thing we can do. And within the context of this book, of these three books, it's the only thing worth doing. The only thing. This isn't physical warfare. It's spiritual warfare. And to fight it, you need spirit, not arms and legs, or a rosy future, or wide open spaces. I can't pretend to understand the plight of someone who is addicted to crack, or sentenced to life imprisonment, or confined to a hospice, or an asylum, or a wheelchair. But I can, with certainty and conviction, say this. In my own process, my own struggle and journey of awakening, of dying to the false and being born to the new, no physical encumbrance would have been any match for my will, and may if anything, have proven quite advantageous. The very idea that my physical circumstances would have prevented my awakening, so long as my mental and emotional resources were reasonably intact, is, to my certain knowledge, absurd. To further support this point, I repeat the words of Melville Ahab that I included in Incorrect. "What I've dared, I've willed, and what I've willed, I'll do. They think me mad, but I'm demoniac. I am madness maddened, that wild madness that's only calm to comprehend itself. The prophecy was that I should be dismembered, and I lost this leg. I now prophesy that I will dismember my dismemberer. Swerve me? The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails, whereupon my soul is grooved to run, over unsounded gorges, through the rifled hearts of mountains, under torrents' beds, unerringly I rush. Knots an obstacle, knots an angle to the iron way." What Brett did, I continue, was instead of finding a way out of life, she found a way in. Like a judo master, she turned this father demon's energy to her own advantage. She figured she was finished anyway, between the progressing cancer and this father presence poisoning her existence. So she realized she had nothing to lose. If I might digress for a moment, I'd like to say that I have nothing but good things to say about this particular realization. Nothing to lose. It's perfectly true of everyone, all the time. But it's the realizing part that's tricky. Once you get to that realization, though, not just conceptually, but fully absorbed throughout your awareness, then this whole thing just bursts wide open. Walls come down, and the universe opens up. Anyway, where was I? Who asked if there was a way to put a demon to good use? Shanti? She nods. Well, that's exactly what Brett did. As she explained it to me, everything was just coming apart. She had the cancer with gloomy prospects, and she still had this dumb father thing yapping in her head, blaming her for everything, blaming her for being sick. She sought help. She looked to religion and the self-help aisles of bookstores. But no matter what she did, no matter where she turned, no matter what book she read or what method or ideology she tried to embrace, there was still this voice in her head telling her that it was all just nonsense, that she was too scared to face facts, that she wasn't brave, that she was being an idiot, a fool. All sort of nasty, negative things, on and on like that. And all the while, she's just getting sicker, and her time is getting shorter. Then one day, her search for answers and meaning having yielded no fruit, she realized that this voice in her head might not be totally wrong. It was very cynical and abrasive, but not necessarily incorrect. The more her illness drove her to seek answers, the more she found herself agreeing with her father's voice. All the answers she was finding were nonsense. When it came to her search for answers, for meaning, for ways to cope with her disease and her mortality, this cynical voice in her head was saying things she not only couldn't deny, but with which she agreed. I wish she were here to explain this to you the way she explained it to me. But the main thrust is that this is how she processed herself into the truth-realized state. Instead of working through it with a tool like spiritual autolysis, she did it with the aid of this built-in, hypersensitive bullshit detector that had been plaguing her for so many years. She was operating under what she believed to be a sentence of imminent death. She thought she was in her final months, and she was intent on getting to the bottom of things, finding the meaning in things. She wanted to find something real, something true. "Did she think she was possessed?" asked Ronald. No, rationally, she knew she wasn't possessed by a demon. She knew that this voice wasn't really her father, but her own creation, some part of herself speaking, some buried or subconscious part of her trying to express itself. That was part of her decision to stop fighting it and start trying to make sense of it. She told me that during this period, she walked around her lake thousands of times, sometimes 20 laps a day, and that's more than a mile around. I recognized that behavior right away. That level of intense, angry energy is common in the awakening process. And while she was doing that, walking lap after lap around the lake, she was arguing with this father voice in her head. They were debating, out loud. She was vocalizing both sides of the conversation. Imagine what a head case she must have looked like to the ducks and frogs. Everyone laughs. That's another common feature of the awakening process, the loss of regard for convention and normalcy. All thought for keeping up appearances falls away. Hours at a time, walking the path around the lake, lap after lap, hour after hour, day and night, month after month. It started with Brett screaming at her father. But at some point, they came into alignment and started working together until, after more than a year of this feverish walking and ranting, Brett absorbed this harsh, critical voice, which was always, of course, a part of her. This father demon was that small voice of reason in her mind, screaming to be heard, and she pushed aside all her emotional resistance and let it speak. Think about her situation for a minute. She never had any desire for spiritual attainment of any kind, in any sense. She never went in for any sort of belief system. She wasn't following a path or a teacher. She wasn't trying to evolve or burn karma or raise her consciousness. Nothing like that. She was just trying to deal with her shit honestly, her words. And that's what it looked like in her case. Like a very sick lady walking laps around a lake, carrying on this lunatic dialogue, processing herself out of her own bullshit. This wasn't just her bid for freedom. It was her healing process. Over time, she subdued this demon voice in her head, completely eradicated the cancer from her body, and found the answers for which she so desperately searched. Now, you're all being very nice and listening because you think that all this demon stuff was Brett's thing and doesn't really have much to do with you. But you're wrong. This is all about you. I've mentioned that I was going to share two techniques with you all tonight. One is what Brett did, demon taming, which is interesting and illuminating, but would only be useful for someone who has an unusually powerful and vocal demon raging in their head. The other, memento mori, is for everyone, everywhere. Every living human being, regardless of religion or nationality or whatever, should begin practicing memento mori right away and every day. "What is it?" asks Nicole. "What does memento mori mean?" It means we do have this powerful and vocal demon raging in our head, and not just any demon, the king of demons, the boogeyman. But we drown him out with every thought and feeling, every minute of our lives. We all have our own personal demon inside of us, and our lives are completely dedicated to denying it. But if we want to awaken, we have to stop hiding from this demon king that lives inside us. We have to turn around and face this big, bad boogeyman. That's what memento mori means. "So what do we have to do?" asks Justin. "Kill the boogeyman?" Everyone laughs. I laugh too. "Don't be silly," I say. "You can't kill the boogeyman." The laughing dies down. "Let's go down to the lake and light a big fire and tell some scary stories."